This is the Leonard Lopate Show. I'm Jonathan Capehart, filling in today for Leonard Lopate. We, the people of the United States of America, look to the Constitution to help us resolve political disputes over voting rights, gerrymandering, the Electoral College, and other issues. But what if those disputes have arisen directly from limitations, ambiguities, and bad ideas that were written into the Constitution itself? That's the question at the heart of Cynthia and Sanford Levinson's new book, Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. I just lost myself in my own introduction. It identifies problems with the Constitution and suggests solutions. Cynthia Levinson is the author of several critically acclaimed books for young adults. Her husband, Sanford Levinson, who goes by Sandy, right, Sandy?
Yep. Yep.
Is one of the country's leading constitutional scholars, a University of Texas law professor, and a visiting professor at Harvard Law School. Their book is just out from Peachtree Publishers, and I'm pleased it brings both of them to the show today. Welcome.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, before we get into it, I'm just going to say that you two are blogging and updating this book every couple weeks?
Yes, the book is so timely that we update it at www.faultlinesinthconstitution.com every 2 weeks.
Okay, and we're going to mention that again at the end, but I say that up at the beginning so that it primes people to listen to what we're going to talk about. So, why did you feel it was important to write this book now? Or have this book now?
Well, actually, our editor asked us to write it because she had a sense several years ago that this was going to be very important. And it turns out to be even more timely than we were aware because there's such increased interest in the Constitution because of the most recent presidential election.
situation that we're in.
I mean, let me repeat one thing from your introduction, that Cynthia really is a deservedly prize-winning author for children. And her editor, who had given her father a book that I wrote, decidedly not for children, said that there really ought to be something like this, and Cynthia could write it, or we could write it together. And that's the origin of the book.
Right. This is meant for middle schoolers.
Middle school and high schoolers.
Right.
That's right.
And their parents and grandparents.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, civics aren't even taught in the schools anymore. Is that right?
That's pretty true. We actually talked to 150 New York area high school teachers on Saturday, and they talked about the difficulty these days of making room for civics in the classroom. But there are statistics that show that young people who take civics have half again as likely a chance or more likely to vote in elections if they've studied civics.
Yeah. Let me also say that to the extent that civics courses are taught, they often focus much more on constitutional rights, because constitutional structures are often regarded as dull and boring. And one of the things that's really different, and I would say truly important in our book, is that although we do mention constitutional rights every now and then, we really focus on the extent to which the structures are crucially important and are the fault lines that are so problematic.
You know, the way the Constitution is discussed, particularly by folks on the right, is that it's almost as if it's the twin tablets that have been brought down from the mountain, and it's hard and fast and unamendable. But in your book's introduction, you say that the framers who created the Constitution at the 1787 Constitutional Convention weren't certain about every decision they made. So didn't everybody involved need to do a great deal of negotiating and debating and compromising to produce a finished document?
Right. There were two central compromises in Philadelphia, and we talk about both of them. One of them is often called the Great Compromise, capital G, capital C, which gives today Wyoming the same two votes in the Senate as California. James Madison detested it. He referred to this feature of the Senate as a lesser evil. The word I focus on is evil. What made it lesser is that it was the price to be paid to get the Constitution. The other compromise, and people never referred to this as a great compromise, was slavery. Mm-hmm. And the consequences of that compromise afflict us this very day.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Even at the time, they knew that they had to be making mistakes. In fact, we quote Thomas Jefferson, who was not at the convention, but he later said, "Manners and opinions change with the change of circumstances. Institutions must also keep pace with the times." So they knew they were making mistakes. In fact, we also quote Madison in regard to the Great Compromise. He said, "Equal representation will injure the majority of the people." And we think that the Senate is one of the major injustices because it arose out of slavery.
Mm-hmm. And the Senate, because you each state, no matter their size of population, they get two votes, two senators.
Right. It's not simply an abstract injustice that clearly violates any notion of one person, one vote. But we talk in the book about how it is that childhood obesity relates to the Senate.
Oh, yeah. I was going to ask about that. Just go ahead. Answer the question I was going to ask in the a little later on. But the Senate has contributed to obesity.
Yeah, isn't that fascinating? It's true. So one of the statistics that we have in the book says that more than half the population, that 150 million people, spread across 41 states, they get 82 senators. The rest of the population, 153 million actually, live in only 9 states. They get the remaining 18 senators. What that means is that the population, the less than half the population, lives in the larger number of states. They're spread around because that land is not being lived on. It's arable property that's being farmed. Since the 1930s, the Senate has allocated a supplement to farmers, and many of them grow corn. Corn, then, they have to find a use for it. So corn syrup is in large numbers of foods that
everything.
We consume.
Yep.
Yeah, it is in everything. Even in things you wouldn't guess. I was given a bag of pretzels on the airline. Why would pretzels need to have corn syrup? Yeah. Well, because there's a lot of corn in production, and they got to find use for it. Go ahead.
Right. I mean, it's the upper Midwest, relatively small population, but it really doesn't matter what the population is. If we were we are updating the book on the blog. I suspect we will blog sometime in the next couple of months about coal. And if you look at the largest coal producers, they're Montana, Kentucky, West Virginia, and Wyoming, 8 votes out of 100, and their senators really, really care. It turns out, and this surprised me, we both live in Texas about 6.5 months, 7 months of the year. I didn't realize that Texas is also a fairly major coal-producing state. But let me tell you, it's not a major part of Texas politics. Where it's a defining part of the politics of the smaller states.
Right, and West Virginia.
And if you want to know why it's so difficult to get a handle on global warming, to shift. Texas is actually the leading wind energy producing state in the country now. But if you want to know why the other states are going to fight to the death and might succeed, it's because of the Senate.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move away from the Senate as the as the lesser of the two evils, and come back to the question of, and you read earlier, Cynthia, the quotes from Madison and Jefferson, basically arguing that the Constitution is a living document. And so they meant for the Constitution not to be written in stone, but to be something that changes with the times.
Absolutely. Well, a really good example of that, of course, is the Electoral College. The Electoral College really did have a reason for being at the time. The framers came up with it just in the last 10 days or so of that Constitutional Convention in 1787. So it wasn't actually very well thought through, but there were reasons for it. And the reasons had to do with the fact that the population then was very dispersed. And of course, media was nowhere near what exists today. People in South Carolina would have no way to know who might be running for the presidency in, say, Massachusetts or Pennsylvania. So it made sense. And also, the framers didn't trust
They didn't trust the people.
That was the other part.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. So they came up with this idea of the people voting for electors whom they would trust, and the electors, even though they didn't get together, would be likely to know or be able to find out about the candidates for presidency. So that's why the Electoral College came to be. These days, it makes absolutely no sense. In fact, it makes nonsense.
Right. I mean, one of the things we do not do is bash the founders. That they were faced with a very difficult political situation. We can agree or disagree with certain choices they made, but our book is not out to bash them. If we bash anybody, frankly, it is ourselves for not having the spirit of the founding generation to be guided by what they called over and over again the lessons of experience. and not to feel that they absolutely had to preserve the status quo.
Mm-hmm. I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate, speaking with Cynthia and Sandy Levinson about their book, Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. One of the ways to maybe get rid of the Electoral College would be a constitutional convention. But one of the, well, let me speak for myself. My fear of a constitutional convention is that given the state of politics now and the state of Congress now, all sorts of nefarious things could happen. So you try to, you get rid of the Electoral College, but then you get rid of or institute a whole lot of other things. Are you not concerned by that possibility?
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up, Jonathan. Thank you for presenting my perspective. The entire book, with the exception of the last chapter, is written in one voice, as if Sandy and I are one person. The last chapter, however, we have a debate, literally, with each other. Sandy is a longtime proponent of a constitutional convention. That just scares me to pieces, not only because of what might come out of it, but even more particularly, how to get into it. There are no procedures that are known or laid out about who would go, what authority people would have, what the processes would be, what the ratification necessary would be. I think there would be so many fights over that, we'd barely get started. But I will let Sandy speak in favor of the convention.
Two quick points. First, with regard to the Electoral College, we could get rid of the Electoral College by constitutional amendment. The reason we're not going to get the constitutional amendment is in part because Article 5 makes the Constitution so difficult to amend, and B, you have to go through the Congress itself that would vote against it. If we lived in California, for example, or several other states in the country, we the people, rightly or wrongly, but I think there are attractive features to direct democracy, we the people could put on the ballot a constitutional amendment that would get rid of the Electoral College, and we wouldn't have to worry about crossing the hurdles presented. There have been 600 amendments introduced in Congress in the Electoral College. None of them has ever gotten through. If you had direct democracy, I think we could get rid of it. Now, to answer more directly the point, I think that we overestimate the fears of a so-called runaway convention because, rightly or wrongly, the difficulty of amending the Constitution, the fact that it would have to get ratification by 38 states, means that crazy proposals, whether of the left or the right, would simply not get enough votes. Also, one other very important thing. As I said before, our book is focused on structures. And my view is that if you brought, whoever your views are, the most partisan Democrat, most partisan Republicans in today's Congress, if you brought them on your program and asked, okay, what veto power do you think the president should have in 2024? I think they could have a civil, informed discussion about the extent to which you want one person to be able to strike down legislation that actually gets through the hurdles presented by bicameralism.
Sandy, I wish I could share your optimistic outlook that crazy proposals wouldn't get through, given everything that we've seen. But I can't let you go without asking the question that a lot of people around the country are asking, particularly about this particular president and the time that we're in, the 25th Amendment. Yep. It's not as simple like it. I think it was in the movie Air Force One, where they're running around in the Situation Room having people sign the thing saying that the president is incapacitated and that the vice president's taking over. It's not that simple, is it?
No, I'm going to let Sandy respond to that. He's really the expert on this.
Well, you're absolutely right. It's not that simple. The 25th Amendment was put there really for the problem if, say, John Kennedy had survived in a coma, or Woodrow Wilson, who had a debilitating stroke. We've never really confronted the problem of a mentally disturbed president. One of the things we talk about in our book, and what I now believe, that is this very day, people ask me, what do you think are the central fault lines, the most important fault line? I think the most important fault line is our fixation on that the president has a guaranteed four-year term unless we can prove that he's a crook or disabled. I very, very much wish We had a procedure by which Congress could vote no confidence. You don't have to bring in the lawyers. You simply have a political debate. Do you have confidence in this person? Or to evoke California again, but also Wisconsin, if we had a procedure for recall. I think that our politics would be completely different if we didn't feel stuck by impeachment and the 25th Amendment as the only ways of getting rid of Donald Trump.
I think it's possible that, again, the framers had some idea of what they were doing at the time, although, of course, it is very vague or limited. But since then, we've developed political parties.
Mm-hmm.
They were assuming they were not going to be any factions, but we have them now. And so that limits us, that constrains us a great deal, as it would even under a parliamentary system. But still, we're very much limited because of the political party situation.
Right. And go ahead, Sam, real quickly.
I was going to say, you know, the most anguishing of the Federalist Papers to read in 2017 is Federalist 68, where Alexander Hamilton reassures us that the purpose of the Electoral College is to make sure that we never get a president who is less than sterling.
Oh, my. I hear the music. Before we go, you're updating this book every 2 weeks on your blog.
Yep.
What's the address again?
www.faultlinesinthe constitution.com.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, filling in for Leonard Lopate. I've been speaking with award-winning children's book author Cynthia Levinson and her husband, the constitutional law professor Sanford Levinson, Sandy Levinson, about their new book, Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. Thanks so much for joining me.